This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And in today's program, we go deep on Afghanistan and the circumstances surrounding recent events in the Tangi Valley, where a helicopter crash on a mysterious mission resulted in the greatest single loss of American military lives in that occupied nation in more than a decade to attempt to contain and control the various populations in Afghanistan. We will be speaking live with Dr. John Prados of the National Security Archives. He's the author most recently of a new book called The Normandy Crucible. He's also an analyst of military and intelligence documents from Iraq and Afghanistan all the way back to Vietnam. Also today, we will present an acoustic rendition of a secret United States military intelligence document that assesses the real problems between United States occupiers and Afghan troops and intelligence and military personnel. It is called A Crisis of Trust and Cultural Incompatibility, a red team study of mutual perceptions of Afghan National Security Force personnel and U.S. soldiers. It emphasizes the increasing spate of killings of American troops by resentful Afghan nationals. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And today we analyze the recent events in the Tangi Valley on the border region between Vardak and Logar provinces, just a short distance southwest of Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, where there was a strange operation that concluded in the crash of a Chinook helicopter and the single largest U.S. military fatality in a decade of military occupation of that country. We presume that at this moment, the executive military and intelligence branches of the United States government are busy investigating, covering up, analyzing, and spinning what happened in Afghanistan over the past few days. To help us decode those events, we are very honored and privileged to have with us Dr. John Prados. He's the director of the National Security Archives Iraq Documentation Project. He is also the director of its Vietnam Project and a senior research fellow on national security affairs. He has a PhD on international relations from Columbia University, and among his many publications are Vietnam, The History of an Unwinnable War, How the Cold War Ended, and his most recent, Normandy Crucible, about World War II, in addition to such other publications as Safe for Democracy, The Secret Wars of the CIA. Dr. Prados's works are indispensable to a deep understanding of statecraft, military strategy, and intelligence operations. We welcome you, Doctor, to 5 o'clock shadow today, and begin with the obvious or at least apparent question, what the hell just happened in Afghanistan?
Well, thank you for that welcome. As far as Afghanistan events are concerned, I think we're going to have to wait a while to find out what was going on. I've heard at least three different versions of what happened and what was in progress over there. And I rather think that the problem is going to be one of divining what low-level operations are all about. You know, unlike some other conflict situations, Afghanistan is really a war of posts and alarms and patrols, and so the combat actions are minute. This is another minute combat action. It's not a large-scale offensive like what we were doing down by Kandahar.
The situation of the events that happened over the weekend are tempting to some form of analysis. In particular, there are reports emanating from Afghan intelligence officials that assert that the incident may have been the result of a trap. I don't know if those claims are true, but Agence France-Presse is quoting Afghan intelligence officials as saying that this target was fed to the ISAF or USG forces with the disinformative rumor that there was a meeting of middle management to Mujahideen or members of the Taliban, and placing it at a location where there are canyons such that ambush sharpshooters or rocket launchers could be placed, and leading to the inevitable tragedy. One also has to wonder about why, after sending a platoon of Rangers, then an additional loaded Chinook with two dozen members of the DEVGRU, the Special Warfare Developments Group, and others come in there. It sounds like a setup. Do you find anything anomalous about the tactics that were employed there?
Well, I think we can tell some things from the layout of the situation. Let me put it this way. First of all, there's a general security problem in that province, which was handed over to the Afghans, and where security had deteriorated. So American commanders and ISAF commanders, no doubt, were sensitive to putting in some kind of a reaction situation. But to go to what you're positing here, the fact that a Ranger unit was being used in the first instance and there was a quick reaction force that was composed of SEALs definitely suggests that they were acting on the basis of some intelligence that they thought was of a high level as opposed to a simple security operation. The fact that the terrain, I would not put too much stock in the specific terrain situation because that kind of terrain characterizes this whole portion of Afghanistan. But it's certainly true that helicopters in particular are especially vulnerable in those kinds of terrain situations because there you can have defending troops who can fire down on the helicopters where the helicopter is completely unable to maneuver.
Dr. Prados, let's then zoom back to the more strategic considerations of the U.S. and international presence in Afghanistan. It's my understanding that the Pesh Valley, where this incident took place, is one of quite a number of regions that are lowly populated but highly contested by the local opposition. And I'm wondering if the pattern over the past several months of U.S. withdrawal from those regions and the presumed putting up of local Afghan troops and trainees to, quote, control, quote, those areas, means that that's a moving target, that the withdrawal of the United States is not at all tractable if one presumes that the goal is to stay there and dominate affairs in Afghanistan. Do you think that the withdrawal is unsuccessful?
This is a very thorny question, and I tend to agree with you that the withdrawal is unsuccessful. The American commanders are caught between a national policy, a national declaratory policy that the United States is leaving the country and turning it over to the Afghans versus a deteriorating military situation. One thing that puzzles me about what's going on is how we're repeatedly being given this line that we are successful in Afghanistan, that the turning over of these areas to Afghan security forces demonstrates the success versus a continuing and even escalating pattern of events, achievements, if we could call them that, by the other side. Their ability to assassinate high-level government officials, their ability to pull off something like this last battle in the Pesh Valley, their ability to counteract the big American offensive, which I mentioned, around Kandahar. The fact that they could wipe out the brother of the president of Afghanistan should give us pause right there. Yet, I haven't heard any change in the positions or the statements or declarations being given by American officials who are telling us that we're successful. So very troubling situation.
Let's now then zoom back calendrically and review the fact that the number of troops in Afghanistan was doubled by President Barack Obama. Roughly speaking, President George W. Bush sent in on the order of 30,000 or so, and Obama 70,000 or so, including what is called the most recent surge. Do you see a strategic collision coming between the promises of withdrawal of 30,000 troops within the next year and the intention to persist in counterinsurgency operations?
Yes, I do, because our punitive withdrawal is predicated on this idea of success, and events on the ground don't seem to be demonstrating the success that we're talking about. I think that commanders and policymakers both are going to be caught between these two contradictory trends in the situation. You know, back in the Vietnam War, which I talk about in the book Unwinnable War, which you so kindly mentioned, one of the things that I talk about is that there was a so-called data problem, a Vietnam data problem. That was that we couldn't get a real reading of what was going on in country. And I think that problem has replicated itself in Afghanistan. We're not getting a real reading of what's happening out of what we're hearing from our official sources.
We're speaking with Dr. John Prados. He is a senior analyst with the National Security Archive. And John, one of the treasures that you have brought to an incompletely informed world is the book Volume 2, Afghanistan, Lessons from the Last War, U.S. Analysis of the Soviet War in Afghanistan, Declassified. And in that, you present various Defense Intelligence Agency estimates and CIA and other types of documents, which suggest two things, that the Soviets lost heavily in their decade-long attempted occupation of Afghanistan. And some of the documents that you've presented in regard to similar issues in Vietnam, you point us to a phenomenon of decreasing intelligence as one moves up the military ranks, where subordinates in intelligence agencies and in military commands tend to say what they think their superiors want to hear. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. The temptation to tell a superior what you think he wants to know is very strong in any military and indeed intelligence agency. And at the same time, the commander's willingness to entertain information that goes against his prior dispositions is also limited because his knowledge of higher strategy and of national policy may go against the information that he's getting from his lower levels. So there are actually factors on both sides of the equation that militate against accuracy in information and real understanding of the opposition. These are the kinds of things that intelligence agencies and military structures theoretically work to compensate for, and they talk a lot about compensating for them, but in practice on the ground, it often doesn't work out that way. In the case of our own situation, until the recent departure of General Petraeus, who's now gone to head the CIA itself, there was a strong disposition to believe in the success of the strategy. And I think that's similar to the kind of structure that existed for the first few years of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan when they were fighting the Mujahideen, who were being supplied by the CIA. The Soviets also didn't want to believe that they had a problem, and they thought that they had the country well organized. And by the way, they even had some advantages comparatively speaking to our own situation in Afghanistan, because they had an Afghan government structure and a political party with some ideological commitment to their operational activity, which is a factor that the United States completely lacks in our own Afghan involvement. So in some respects, I think this situation, too, is replicating itself in our Afghan war.
You anticipate me. You did the third and final zoom back to the geostrategic comparison between the United States and the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. We're speaking with Dr. John Prados of the National Security Archive. And just to conclude, I'm very eager to see your next work, which is called Normandy Crucible, about World War II, Nespa.
That's right. How the Allies broke out of Normandy and ran for the German frontier.
Tell us more.
Well, sure. Talk about intelligence. This is another intelligence situation where in our writings on that subject, we don't really integrate this whole feature into the general histories and our general understanding. And yet, we have developed a great deal of knowledge about what the intelligence was and when we got it and stuff like that, and we haven't appreciated that impact on our own strategy or, for that matter, the strategy on the other side. So I wrote that book to sort of suggest that we're able to produce now a new generation of histories of World War II that incorporate the intelligence aspects into our general histories of the war.
Dr. John Prados is a senior fellow and director of the Archives Documentation Project on Iraq, as well as Vietnam. And we thank you so much for being with us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow. How can people contact the archive and follow your work?
Our email is NSARCHIV, that's archive without the E, at gwu.edu. Or you can simply Google National Security Archive, and it will lead you directly to our website.
Thank you so much, Dr. John Prados.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's been an honor. And this is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Continuing on this thread of going deep on Afghanistan, we hear next an exclusive audio presentation of a military analysis document regarding Afghanistan that attempted to be classified, but copies were around, and we have obtained one of them and present that to you here today. The document was commissioned as a red team study of mutual perceptions of Afghan and American relations in the military cauldron there. It's titled A Crisis of Trust and Cultural Incompatibility. And the author, Dr. Jeffrey Borden of the Red Team Political and Military Behavioral Scientists crew makes a very strong case that Afghan killings of American soldiers are based on a decade of attempted merging, but of mutual contempt, of cultural distress, of abusive and insulting behavior. And he says that despite repeated official euphemisms and pronouncements of hopeful optimism, that there are very serious problems, including an increasing rate of fratricide, in which the military people of the different nations are not exactly allies to an alarming degree, but at each other's throats. He concludes that, unfortunately, the rapidly growing fratricide murder trend committed by Afghan National Security Forces personnel against international members of the military there is a valid counterintelligence measure of the ineffectiveness in U.S. efforts in stabilizing Afghanistan. We now hear the essence of this military report that was classified. We present it now here on 5 O'Clock Shadow.
A crisis of trust and cultural incompatibility. A red team study of mutual perceptions of Afghan National Security Force personnel and U.S. soldiers in understanding and mitigating the phenomena of ANSF-committed fratricide murders. By Jeffrey Borden, Ph.D. N2. KL Red Team Political and Military Behavioral Scientist. May 12, 2011. Executive Summary. Since May 2007, there have been at least 26 murder or attempted murder incidents by Afghan National Security Force or Afghan Security Guard members against International Security Assistance Force and/or United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan members, resulting in the killings of at least 58 Western personnel. Most of these incidents have occurred since October 2009, representing 6% of all hostile deaths by ISAF during this period. Such fratricide murder incidents are no longer isolated. They reflect a growing systemic threat. They are also provoking a crisis of confidence and trust among Westerners training and working with ANSFs. Rather than just a result of insurgent infiltration into Afghan National Security Force, indicators exist that many of these fratricide incidents resulted from personal clashes. Therefore, a field study was undertaken to assess Afghan National Security Force members and U.S. soldiers' perceptions of each other. Specifically, to identify those behaviors that upset them or cause anger. 68 focus groups were conducted on 613 Afghan National Security Force personnel throughout three provinces at 19 locations. Their reported negative views, experiences and observations of U.S. soldiers' social behaviors were recorded. Afghan National Security Force members identified numerous social, cultural and operational grievances they have with U.S. soldiers. Factors that created animosity were reviewed through a content analysis that measured frequency and intensity of the perceived grievances. Factors that fueled the most animosity included U.S. convoys not allowing traffic to pass, reportedly indiscriminate return U.S. fire that causes civilian casualties, naively using flawed intelligence sources, U.S. forces conducting night raids and home searches, violating female privacy during searches, U.S. roadblocks, publicly searching or disarming Afghan National Security Force members as an SOP when they enter bases, and past massacres of civilians by U.S. forces such as the Wedding Party Massacre, the Shinwar Massacre, etc. Other issues that led to altercations or near altercations including many self-reported near fratricide incidents included urinating in public, they're cursing it, insulting and being rude and vulgar to Afghan National Security Force members, and unnecessarily shooting animals. They found many U.S. soldiers to be extremely arrogant, bullying, unwilling to listen to their advice, and were often seen as lacking concern for civilian and Afghan National Security Force safety during combat. 30 interpreters' views were similar to the ANSF. 215 U.S. soldiers' views of Afghan National Security Force, particularly of the Afghan National Army, were also collected. They were extremely negative. They reported pervasive illicit drug use, massive thievery, personal instability, dishonesty, no integrity, incompetence, unsafe weapons handling, corrupt officers, no real NCO corps, covert alliances and informal treaties with insurgents, high AWOL rates, bad morale, laziness, repulsive hygiene and the torture of dogs. Perceptions of civilians were also negative stemming from their insurgent sympathies and cruelty towards women and children. Recommendations included ensuring improved convoy driving practices, explaining need for roadblocks, vetting and training special Afghan National Security Force search teams including more females, reviewing base security standard operating procedures, monitoring religious radicalism in Afghan National Security Force, reforming various dysfunctional ANSF practices, improving ANSF evaluation metrics, conducting more research in local patterns of life, and developing improved cultural and human relations trainings and behavior standards. Introduction. This N2 KL Red Team study has four primary purposes. 1. Inform key decision makers that the murders of ISAF members committed by Afghan National Security Force personnel do not represent so-called rare and isolated events as currently being proclaimed. 2. Explore why this tragic phenomenon is occurring by extensively canvassing ANSF members on their perceptions of U.S. soldiers and identifying what behaviors, characteristics and/or situations provoke them towards anger and possible violence. 3. Examine U.S. soldiers' experiences with Afghan National Security Force personnel and what perceptions they have. 4. Based on both Afghan National Security Force members and U.S. soldiers' perceptions, develop recommendations to counter the growing fratricide murder threat Afghan National Security Force personnel pose to ISAF soldiers. Conclusion. Despite repeated official euphemistic pronouncements of alleged hopeful optimism and fragile progress, pernicious intuitive-based rhetorical illusions that has fully ejected all critical analysis from deliberations, The war of perceptions is not going well in Afghanistan, and the results of the present study add to a litany of recent research reports, journalistic accounts and social atmospheric studies that sound this warning. However, rather than primarily being a result of any effective Taliban-sponsored propaganda which remains quite impactful, much of this problem is of our own making. We have very often been our own worst enemy in winning the allegiance of the Afghans. Many of the policies and behaviors of ISAF have been and continue to be self-defeating, including the prolonged and gross neglect in dealing with government of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan, pervasive corruption. As was mentioned by several Afghan National Security Force members, for many years U.S. and other ISAF military convoys sped through the streets of local Afghan villages, running down small children who could not get out of the way fast enough, while shouting profanities and throwing water bottles at people from their turrets. Even then, the obtuse questions among many ISAF members included, why don't they like us? And, why don't they warn us about the IEDs planted in the road? Although such driving SOPs have largely been reformed, bitter memories and hatred linger. Improvised explosive devices have long become the number one worst killer of ISAF soldiers, despite the tens of billions spent since 2006 in high technologies to counter them. A tragedy that simple common sense and decency had not been implemented much earlier into ISAF doctrinal driving practices. And according to many of the study participants, as well as other recent research and journalistic accounts, there continue to be many ISAF policies, actions and behaviors that infuriate and alienate much of the Afghan populace, including our armed Afghan National Security Force counterparts. We lack the luxury to continue to volitionally ignore such personal, social and cultural violations, or to be ignorant of them in the first place. ISAF emphasis on quantity over quality with regard to the ANSF buildup has been self-destructive. Such an approach has placed U.S. and other ISAF soldiers in profoundly difficult circumstances by having to train Afghans who are illiterate, unmotivated with an annual attrition rate of 25% mostly due to desertion, often drug addicted, very often come from the least desired segments of Afghan society, and are somewhat prone to turning on and murdering their Western trainers. ISAF host nations should be fully aware of the magnitude of the dangers their sons and daughters face when assigned to train, mentor and work with Afghan National Security Force personnel. ISAF personnel are then expected to transform them into legitimate functional soldiers and policemen, all while having no authority to hold any of them accountable for their criminal behaviors and/or incompetence. ISAF soldiers engaged in training and partnering must also work with deeply flawed Afghan institutions that are little more than organized crime syndicates and where accountability is almost unheard of. Dealing with such organizational cultures and operational working conditions and limitations cause great stress and exasperation for ISAF troops. Unless fundamental changes are made to ISAF ability to institute reform on profoundly dysfunctional Afghan governmental systems and key leaders, then any efforts in developing a legitimate, functional and trustworthy Afghan army and police force will continue to be futile. Unfortunately, the rapidly growing fratricide murder trend committed by Afghan National Security Force personnel against ISAF members is a valid counter-insurgency measure of the ineffectiveness in our efforts in stabilizing Afghanistan, developing a legitimate and effective government, battling the insurgency, gaining the loyalty, respect and friendship of the Afghans, building the ANSFs into legitimate and functional organizations, and challenges the efficacy of the partnering concept. This is all the more a paradox given ISAF assumption of and planned reliance for the ANSFs to be able to take over the security burden before it can disengage from this grossly prolonged conflict. The study shows that certain behaviors and policies such as night raids and home searches that directly involve U.S. soldiers have generated a great deal of animosity among much of the Afghan civilian populace as well as with many Afghan National Security Force personnel that impedes the overall strategic effort. Such practices are simply unacceptable if ISAF is to be even marginally successful here. Regrettably, our ISAF troops in the field are bearing the consequences by being murdered in increasingly unprecedented numbers by the very Afghan National Security Force members they are here to mentor, train and supposedly partner with. Such fratricide is fast leading to a crisis of trust between the two forces, if it has not reached this point already. A crisis of trust and cultural incompatibility. A Red Team study of mutual perceptions of Afghan National Security Force personnel and U.S. soldiers in understanding and mitigating the phenomena of ANSF-committed fratricide murders, by Jeffrey Borden, Ph.D.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I am Robert Knight in New York.
Before dawn on Saturday, a senior U.S. military official says elite American Army Rangers launch an operation to target a Taliban compound. It's around midnight, witnesses say, when the Rangers arrive by helicopter in the Tangi Valley, about 60 miles southwest of Kabul. The valley has steep sides of loose shale, almost impenetrable by road. It's a known Taliban stronghold. The Taliban says the firefight lasts 30 to 40 minutes before a twin-rotor Chinook helicopter is called in, full of reinforcements. On board are mostly U.S. Navy SEALs, among the most secretive and deadly of America's special operations forces. The Taliban say one of their fighters fires an RPG from as close as 150 yards away. It hits the Chinook, apparently a lucky shot by the unguided rocket. A witness says the helicopter crashes in the valley by a riverbed. After it crashed, it caught fire, a huge fire. We were not able to come out during the night because the Americans were around. In the morning, we saw the American bodies, he says.
A NATO official said the crash site is now secure, but recovery operations for both equipment and remains are ongoing. Richard Engel, NBC News, Kabul.
Early one morning, with time to kill, I borrowed Jeb's rifle and sat on the hill. I saw a lone rider crossing the plain. I drew a bead on him to practice my aim. My brother's rifle went off in my hand. A shot rang out across the land. The horse he kept running, the rider was dead. I hung my head, I hung my head. I set off running to wake from the dream. My brother's rifle went into the sheen. I kept on running into the Southlands. That's where they found me, my head in my hands. The sheriff, he asked me, why had I run? And then it came to me, just what I had done. And all for no reason, just one piece of lead. I hung my head, I hung my head. Here in the courthouse, the whole town was there. I see the judge high up in his chair. Explain to the courtroom what went through your mind, and we'll ask the jury what verdict they find. I felt the power of death over life. I orphaned his children, I widowed his wife. I beg their forgiveness, I wish I was dead. I hung my head, I hung my head, I hung my head, I hung my head. Early one morning, with time to kill, I see the gallows up on the hill. And out in the distance, a trick of the brain. I see a lone rider crossing the plain. And he come to fetch me to see what they done. And we'll ride together till kingdom come. I pray for God's mercy, cause soon I'll be dead. I hung my head, I hung my head. I hung my head, I hung my head.
One last thing. There is no one who embodies the qualities I mentioned more than the men and women of the United States Armed Forces. And this weekend, we lost 30 of them when their helicopter crashed during a mission in Afghanistan. And their loss is a stark reminder of the risks that our men and women in uniform take every single day on behalf of their country. Day after day, night after night, they carry out missions like this in the face of enemy fire and grave danger. And in this mission, as in so many others, they were also joined by Afghan troops, seven of whom lost their lives as well. So I've spoken to our generals in the field, as well as President Karzai, and I know that our troops will continue the hard work of transitioning to a stronger Afghan government and ensuring that Afghanistan is not a safe haven for terrorists. We will press on, and we will succeed.
Ultimate product of capitalism. Bird brain, chief bureaucrat of Russia, yawning. Bird brain ran FBI 30 years, appointed by FDR, and never chased Cosa Nostra. Bird brain apportioned wheat to be burned, keep prices up on the world's markets. Money to developing nation police states through the World Bank. Bird Brain offers brain transplants in Switzerland. Bird Brain wakes up in the middle of the night and arranges his sheets. I am Bird Brain. Russia, Yugoslavia, England, Poland, Argentina, United States, El Salvador. Bird brain multiplies in Russia, China, and the United States. Bird brain inhabits Stalin's corpse inside the Kremlin wall. Bird brain dictates petrochemical agriculture in Afric desert regions. Birdbrain lowers North California's water table, sucking it up for Orange County agribusiness banks. Birdbrain clubs baby harp seals and wears their coats to Paris. Birdbrain runs the Pentagon, his brother runs the CIA, that of tanks. Birdbrain writes and edits Time, Newsweek, Wall Street Journal, Pravda, Izvestia. Birdbrain is Premier, Premier, Commissar, Chairman, Commissar, Senator, Chairman. Bird Brain prepares Wonder Bread with refined white flour. Bird Brain sold slaves, sugar, tobacco, alcohol. Bird Brain sent 20 million intellectuals and Jews to Siberia. 15 million never got back to the Straight Door Cafe. Wore a mustache and ran Germany on amphetamines the last year of World War II. Bird Brain conceived the final solution to the Jewish problem of Europe. Bird Brain carried it out in gas chambers. Bird Brain borrowed Lucky Luciano, the mafia, from jail to secure Sicily for U.S. Bird Brain against the Reds. Manufactured guns in the Holy Land and sold them to white boys in South Africa. Bird Brain supplied helicopters to Central American generals to kill a lot of restless Indians, encourage a favorable business climate. He began a war of terror against Israeli Jews. Zionist planes to shoot Palestinian huts near Beirut. Bert Green outlawed opiates on the world market. Bert Green formed the black market in opium. Bert Green's father shot Skag in the hallways of the Lower East Side of New York. Organized Operation Condor to spray poison fumes on the marijuana fields of Sonora. Bert Green got sick in Harvard Square from smoking Mexican grass. Bert Green arrived in Europe to conquer cockroaches with propaganda. Bert Green became a great international poet and went around the world praising the glories of Bert Green. I declare Bert Green to be victor in the poetry contest. He built the World Trade Center on New York Harbor without regard where the toilets emptied. He began chopping down the Amazon rainforest to build a wood pulp factory on the riverbank. Bert Green in Iraq attacked Bert Green in Iran. Bert Green in Belfast throws bombs at his miserable. Bert Green wrote Das Kapital, authored the Bible, penned the Wealth of Nations. Bert Green's humanity, he built the rainbow room on top of Rockefeller Center so we could dance. He invented the theory of relativity so Rockwell Corporation could make neutron bombs at Rocky Flats in Colorado. Bert Green's gonna see how long he can go without coming. Bert Green thinks smart, it will grow big that way.
Bert Green found out he was a Buddha by meditating.
Bert Green's afraid he's gonna blow up the planet, so he built this rocket to get away.